Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, it's a mixed bag as we take in a new record for the US stock market and the possibility of the S&P 500 breaching the 4,000 point mark for the first time. We'll also assess the likely impact from the giant US relief package working its way through Congress and the possibility of an historic return of inflation. Is that what governments secretly want to happen? If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. New record highs for markets have, despite all the gloomy news elsewhere in the world, become a regular occurrence in the last year. The US stock market in particular has been pushing higher, and the S&P 500, the index of the largest American companies, stands on the brink of a significant psychological milestone. The S&P may soon pass the 4,000 point mark. Helping that is the expectation that US politicians will soon pass a huge relief bill, putting money directly in the hands of citizens and boosting spending all over the place as well. That in turn has added to the predictions that we will soon see inflation return with a vengeance. To discuss all of it, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, investment director here at Fidelity. Tom, welcome. Let's start, if we may, Tom, with that new high for US shares and the prospect that the S&P will breach 4,000. These barriers shouldn't really mean anything, should they, Tom? But they do tend to get attention.
They certainly do, yes. It's the sort of the tyranny of big round numbers. And it prompted me to have a look at the chart of the S&P 500 ahead of this conversation, actually, because we are getting close to 4,000. I just wanted to have a look and see when we hit the previous big round numbers, because it is quite instructive. So the S&P 500 first went through 1,000 during the dot-com period in the late 1990s. Now, it didn't hit 2,000 for another 15 years after that. I think it was some point in 2014. It then took another 5 years to get to 3,000, which was at the back end of 2019. And as we've just discussed, we're heading towards 4,000. Now, what you have to bear in mind, of course, is that moving from 1,000 to 2,000 is, of course, a doubling in the market level. So that's a pretty significant rise. The move from 3,000 to 4,000 is an increase of 33%, a third. Mm. So, you know, you would expect to hit these as the market appreciates, you would expect to hit these barriers more and more frequently, and the gap between them to get smaller, which of course is exactly what has happened. So, you know, we shouldn't get too hung up on these round numbers. You know, the difference between 4,000 and 5,000, of course, is only 20%. So, you know, that's in the context of last year, that's a good few months, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, but looking at that chart, though, Tom, I mean, the line is sort of ever steepening, isn't it? I mean, it does look as though, you know, it's quite a precipitous level. And I guess the reminder that this provides us and will provide to some people at least is that we are at quite elevated levels, aren't we, at some parts of the stock market. That's represented by the S&P because it's so dominated by the high quality growth companies, the tech companies that have done so well. It's likely to make people even a little bit more nervous about where the market is.
Yes, I think so. And I think in combination with some of the other things that we've been talking about in recent weeks, you know, the sort of growing sense that there's a sort of higher level of speculative excess in the market is feeding those fears. I think we mustn't just look at the headline numbers. You need to look at the valuation of the market. So how the level of the market compares with the underlying level of earnings and the value of companies in terms of their assets, the dividends that they're paying, etc. And if you look at those measures, yes, the market is a bit more stretched than it has been, but we're not yet at the sort of, you know, very stretched levels that we have been in the past. You know, for example, this period 20 years ago that we talk about a lot, the dot-com bubble, and you know, the stretched valuations are quite limited in terms of geographic scope. So if you get outside the US and you go to the UK market, for example, valuations are really not that stretched at all. I mean, they're kind of in line with their long-term averages. So I don't really buy this sense that the market is very stretched at the moment. And I'm sure we'll come on to some of the reasons why share prices have been rising, and you know they're real, they're legitimate reasons.
Yeah. Well, let's get to that then. I mean, the latest sort of leg up for the US market in particular has been helped by this news in the last few days and weeks that we are making progress, or the US is making progress on a big relief package for the COVID pandemic. The details are still being thrashed out, but it's likely to include large checks being handed directly to some US citizens, at least. Markets tend to like things like that, don't they?
Yeah. So, I mean, the scale of this relief package is not insignificant. I mean, $1.9 trillion is a huge amount of money, and it is only possible because of the political changes that have happened in the US since the November election. So the fact that the Democrats now control the White House and both houses of Congress is very significant here, because it does mean that the president is able to push through a package of measures which, you know, has got its critics. You know, people worry about the impact of spending that much money. But the fact is, he has the power to do it now. It's a narrow majority, but he does have a majority to do it. And the nature of the stimulus is really important too, because you mentioned the fact there that it's going to include large checks. You know, up to sort of $2,000 a person, you know, directly into people's bank accounts. And that's really important, because if you think about the stimulus, the smaller stimulus that happened after the financial crisis, it was largely aimed at securing the stability of the financial system. It was used to bolster the balance sheets of banks. And that had an impact on asset prices. It helped boost the price of stock markets and bond markets. What it didn't do was really put money in the pockets of ordinary people who are likely to spend that money. And that's the difference between then and now. If you give people money and they spend it, then it has a much more direct impact on the economy, and also on things like, you know, related subjects like the inflation rate, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, and we should say that while some citizens in America may get these checks, which is obviously a sort of, on the face of it, an act of generosity, the US in general, it hasn't done the kind of things that we've done here in the UK with furlough schemes and things like that, has it? I mean, the American workers have been sort of left to fend for themselves up until this point. So generous in the moment, but overall, the US maybe hasn't expended the largesse that, say, we have in the UK.
No, I mean, you know, if you look at what's happened in the UK and to a similar degree in some sort of European countries as well, the focus has been very much on providing a safety net, ensuring that the unemployment rate doesn't spiral out of control, and protecting the economy because of that. In the US, it's more of a dog eat dog world. You know, easy to fire, easy to hire, and the unemployment rate soared, and then it has come down quite quickly as well. So it's a different system.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. Well, you mentioned there's some dissenting voices about this relief spending. It's not just the sort of normal debt and deficit hawks saying this. We've had the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers warning that this will unleash a huge wave of inflation, and that view is gaining ground. You can read that in the financial press right now a lot. If these predictions come to pass, we may see a big effect in the markets, in the stock market, and that's something you've been looking at this week, isn't it, Tom?
Yes, so I think, you know, the impact of this, you know, really substantial fiscal stimulus on the stock market is going to be very interesting. And it's going to have different impacts on different sectors, because if we do get a return to an inflationary environment, that is going to benefit sectors like commodities, for example, and this is one of the big areas of focus this week. People are talking about the possibility that we are returning to some kind of a sort of commodities super cycle, a big upswing that will last for many years in commodities prices. And this is, you know, this is itself a cause of inflation. And it's also a sort of, it's also a response to inflation as well. It sort of becomes self-feeding. And one of the reasons why commodity prices stand to rise so much from here is that in the period since the financial crisis, commodities were really out of favour. The growth, the recovery in the economy was pretty sluggish. That meant that demand for commodities, industrial metals, fell, prices fell, and that in turn meant that the big mining companies were less predisposed to invest in productive capacity. So what we've got a situation now, we've got a situation where demand is rising for commodities at the same time as the productive capability of the industry to meet that demand is inadequate. And, you know, it's just basic economics. You know, when demand rises and supply falls, then prices go up, and that is what's happening at the moment. So we saw the copper price, for example, is up about 40% year on year, and this is a really big shift in sort of mindset for you. If you think about investors over the last 10 years, it's all been focused on these sort of capital light industries, technology, those kinds of things. And I think if we are making this shift towards a more commodity focused economy, then that's a big shift for investors.
Indeed, and it relates to something we've spoken about a lot, which is this potential rotation or acceleration of the rotation from these high quality growth companies to more undervalued parts of the market. And when you wrote about this, Tom, this week, what seemed more plausible about those growth to value predictions this time is that there are a couple of big differences, as you say there. We've got the prospect of big spending on things like green measures, you know, decarbonisation in the world's economy. That's going to take a lot of capital. And as you say, that's different from sort of big changes we've had in the past, where, the parts of the more productive economy that have grown have been capital light. And then, of course, we also have this big expansion of state spending and safety nets in developed economies.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, those are two sort of different areas of stimulus, but they're both likely to have a big impact. And just focusing on that first one to start with, this growth in the green economy. I mean, this is this sort of idea of building back better, building a more environmentally sustainable energy system around the world is such a massive task. It's basically, you know, reconfiguring the whole sort of infrastructure of the global energy system. It's on a par with the first stage of industrialization and then sort of building out the railways and the telephone wires and all of those things. Massive investment 100 years ago. We're now talking about potentially a period of 10, 20, 30 years in which massive investment goes into a green energy mix. That is, it's hard to sort of overstate the importance of that for growth and inflation in the economy. And then the other aspect that we talked about there is this. It's almost an abandonment of sort of previous ideas of what constituted fiscal prudence. You know, the sort of the austerity drive that followed the financial crisis has kind of been discredited, and people realize that actually it was counterproductive. It didn't help us, you know, dig ourselves out of the out of the crisis. And the consensual thinking on this now has shifted much more to supporting the economy, supporting the jobs market, creating a safety net. That is going to require very significant amounts of spending. And both of those factors, the green economy and the social safety net, are, you know, intrinsically inflationary events. And I think that's going to have a big impact on the way that we construct our investment portfolios in the years ahead.
Yes. And finally, Tom, I mean, one of the sort of subtexts to all this, and I guess why, you know, a more conspiratorial sort of person may believe that inflation will now turn higher and will be allowed to turn higher, is that it's in the interests of governments to let that happen, isn't it? Because of all the money that they've borrowed.
Yes. I mean, you know, the bottom line is that money cannot be repaid. It is, you know, the amount of money that's been spent in order to repay that through spending cuts or tax rises is really sort of inconceivable. I mean, people would not tolerate the level of spending cuts that would be required or the level of tax rises that would be required to fill that hole. So we've discussed this before. It doesn't leave many options, and the most palatable option politically is to allow the economy to run hot for a time to stoke inflation and effectively to reduce the real cost, the real value of those liabilities. And it will take a number of years for that to happen. It's exactly what happened after the Second World War, which was the last time that we had levels of debt to GDP comparable with what we've got today. That was the policy mix. Keep interest rates low, allow inflation to rise, and just let it take its course and reduce the burden in that way. And I'm sure that that's, you know, what we're going to have. And so I think when you look at the next 10, 15 years, I think you're looking at a much more fundamentally inflationary environment than we've had for a generation.
Okay. Well, Tom, look, that's all we have time for now. Thanks an awful lot for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds, and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.